Welcome to the Liberty Exchange. I'm Jonathan Fortier. My guest today is Bruce Caldwell, professor of economics and director of the Center for the History of Political Economy at Duke University. Bruce is also general editor of the collected works of Friedrich Hayek in 19 volumes published by the University of Chicago Press. A fuller bio of Professor Caldwell is provided in the show notes. Today, we discuss the challenges and rewards of editing Hayek and reflect on the historical context and continued relevance of Hayek's most popular work, The Road to Serfdom, which was published 80 years ago this month in 1944. We conclude with a discussion of Bruce's recent work on publishing the transcripts from the first Mont Pelerin Society meeting in 1947, edited with an introduction by Professor Caldwell, published in 2022. I'm here with Bruce Caldwell on the Liberty Exchange. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Bruce.
Delighted to be here, Jonathan.
We are in the midst of putting together some collections on Hayek to celebrate the 80th anniversary of the publication of The Road to Serfdom, and later in the year, the 50th anniversary of Hayek's Nobel Prize. And we thought it would be perfect to kick off our content and some of our future reflections on Hayek by talking with you, the general editor of the collected Hayek. So we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Great.
I thought we could begin by talking about some of the challenges and some of the high points of taking over the collected Hayek project. It must have occupied much of your time over many years, and I'd be curious to hear about some of the challenges and what it was like taking that over, and maybe you could give us a little sense of the project as a whole.
Sure. So it is a collected works of F.A. Hayek. So the intention is to bring together in a series of volumes his writings, sometimes supplemented by things that were not published. And it was a project that was begun back in the 1980s. And the first general editor was a philosopher of science, W.W. Bartley III, Bill Bartley to some, William to others. But he was a philosopher of science who knew Popper, had worked under Karl Popper, who was a great friend of Hayek's, and he had a very ambitious idea that he would write the biography of Popper, the biography of Hayek, do the collected works of Hayek. It's just he had a great vision of a number of things he wanted to do. And the very first volume of the Hayek collected works was the Hayek's final book, The Fatal Conceit. A number of other volumes were underway, and then Bartley got cancer and died very, very quickly in the early 1990s. And the project was taken over by Stephen Kresge. Stephen Kresge actually commissioned me to do a couple of the volumes in the collected works. And then in the early 2000s, Kresge said that he wanted to step down and asked me if I would take over as the third general editor. So what a general editor does is to commission each one of these volumes. One of the volumes, for example, is the collected works edition of The Road to Serfdom. As general editor at the time, I actually did it myself, but for some of the other volumes, I commissioned other people to do the work. Victor Vanberg, for example, did the one on the sensory order. Hans-Jörg Klausinger, who was my co-author on the biography of Hayek that I recently completed, did a couple of independent volumes on Hayek's monetary thought. So there was a number of different people. Particularly enjoyed the volume by Sandy Peart on Hayek on Mill, for example. So I took over in the early 2000s, and one reason that Kresge wanted me to take over was that he was out of money. The original funders had funded the project when Bartley was in place. A lot of them didn't really know Kresge very well, so he used up the money that he had on hand, and he said, look, if you're going to take this over, you're going to have to also be a fundraiser. And so I tried my hand at that. It was certainly new, and I was pretty bad at it initially, I have to say. It's very strange to walk up to people and say, hi, can you give me millions of dollars for this project that I can describe on paper? And they look at you like, well, no. And so it took a while, but at some point I met the people at Liberty Fund, and they were interested in doing their very high-quality Liberty Fund paperback editions of many of the books in the collected works. So we had a meeting where the University of Chicago Press people and the Liberty Fund people and came to an agreement that Liberty Fund would subsidize in terms of helping pay honoraria and other expenses of publication for the volumes in the collected works that they were producing paperback editions of. And that gave me the money that I needed to complete it. It is a long process. I mean, it started in the 80s, and the final volume of the 19 volumes in the collected works appeared in 2022. And so it's a marvelous collection. I should perhaps explain to your listeners, the point behind a collected works is you take Hayek's various writings, and they're from all over the place. And you're putting him, first of all, together in one place. You're standardizing the footnotes, because the footnotes are from journal articles, from books, from all different places. So you're trying to standardize that. A lot of times the footnotes were inaccurate or incomplete, so that had to be adjusted for. Occasionally there would be explanatory blurbs that would be added to the text to help the reader who might not know what Hayek would be referring to when he made some particular reference from 1933. And then finally, there would be an editor's introduction. So each volume had an introduction that placed the various texts or text itself into context. So it's a lot of work, these volumes. Each one that I did took at least 3 years. And the footnotes alone often would take a year. So a lot of work goes into them. But it is a wonderful way to get an idea of the large dimension of someone's contributions. As you know, as many of your listeners would know, Hayek made contributions to economics, to the philosophy of social science, to political theory, psychology. I mean, he was intellectually curious and roamed widely. So it was a great pleasure, as well as a great task to be the editor of the collected works.
Yeah, it's a tremendous scholarly achievement. I mean, the footnotes are in themselves a world, an education, just in looking through the people with whom Hayek was corresponding and references to contemporary political events and so on and so forth is really incredibly interesting. And it must have been quite an intellectual journey in some sense of putting this together and chasing down all the many threads in Hayek's, as you say, very interdisciplinary, the nature of Hayek's interdisciplinary work.
So I'm an historian of economic thought, and it was a real pleasure to take these deep dives because I'm learning about Hayek, but I'm also learning about all the people he's responding to. So you have to go through it. And when you're doing the job for writing an editor's introduction, you're not only reading Hayek, you're reading a bunch of other people. And you're trying to figure out exactly what the dimensions of the arguments were and how they fit into the time period that you're looking at. So it was actually a wonderful intellectual adventure to do that. And it really stretched me. I mean, yeah, I'm trained as an economist. And here I'm looking at writings that are in many other areas beyond economics and encouraging the editors of the volumes that are doing that and working through the stuff as they're working through some of it as well. Part of what the general editor always was going to do, this was also part of Bartley's vision, was that by the time you complete the task of editing all of Hayek's works, you'd be in the position of writing a biography. And that's what I'm currently engaged in with my co-author Hans-Jörg Klausinger. We have the first volume completed, Hayek, A Life, 1899 to 1950, which takes it right up to the point that he went to the University of Chicago. And this background of doing the collected works has been essential, really, to being able to get a sense of each step that he's taking along his path. So it's been a great adventure. It's not done yet. So we have volume two to come, but that's what we're engaged in right now. I have to say, I'm having a great time.
Will it be a two-volume biography?
Yes, that's right.
Right. So when do you anticipate the second volume to be complete?
That's always a good question, Jonathan, and I wish I had an answer. But we're plugging along, and it takes a while. What we do is we work independently, then we sit down and we fit the things together, and then it goes back and forth. It's an iterative process that last time it took 10 years for volume one. But we had to read all the things that we could that were in the archives, not only Hayek's archives, but those of the major people with whom he was corresponding, as well as we did a lot of interviews. I interviewed Christine Hayek, Hayek's daughter. I talked to Larry Hayek, talked to Lionel Robbins' daughter. Hans Jorg interviewed various people in Austria. And so it was gathering of the material, seeing what we had, and then plotting out the path. And we don't have to do all that background stuff for the second volume because it's already done. So it's more a matter of just trying to fit together our two narratives, try to get the voice that's in the book to be consistent throughout. We have different writing styles, but all of that was something that we've also done in the past. So I think this will go more quickly. So let's put it this way. It won't be 10 years. That will be my response to that good question.
Sure. Yeah. I don't want to pin you down to a date. Are most of Hayek's papers at Hoover?
Yes, they're all at Hoover. It started out with an initial set of papers that he gave, but after he died, more papers came. After his second wife died, more papers came. Then additional papers came from his birth families. You know, so he had two children, Christine and Lawrence, and after their deaths, yet more things came. So it's now up to something like 200 boxes, I think, all at the Hoover Institution. And that was also part of the joy of doing the biography, is I got to know Larry to some extent. He died in 2006, but Christine lived until January of 2022. So I would meet with her every time I'd go to England, a lovely woman. We talked a lot. So I got a lot of background information on the family and all the rest. And as I said, a delightful woman as well.
Yeah. So all of the papers, virtually all the papers required for research in Hayek are at Hoover now.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes. All of the stuff that particularly of things that people sent to him.
Right.
And he did keep copies of things that he sent, but he also moved a lot. So that moving meant that he would not necessarily keep everything that was in his own files. So you do have to go to other people's archives to kind of follow through on some of the various correspondences.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful collection to have for scholars and for the generalist who wants to get a comprehensive sense of Hayek's contribution to not just economics, but to many different disciplines, and to understand his, in a sense, framework of what principles underlie free societies.
Right. Yeah. Exactly right.
Yeah. I thought we could shift to a discussion of The Road to Serfdom, which is, of course, one of Hayek's most popular books. And you edited the edition of The Road to Serfdom for the collected Hayek. And I just reread your introduction to that volume, which I enjoyed very much. One thing that struck me about your introduction and some of my recollections of reading the book many years ago is that much of what is said there resonates today.
Yes,
unfortunately. Some of the debates, unfortunately. Exactly. And I thought I would read a brief passage from your introduction and maybe get your comment about it. You write, "By the end of the decade, there were many other voices calling for the transformation, sometimes radical, of society. A few held a corporatist view of the good society that bordered on fascism. Others sought a middle way. Still others were avowedly socialist. But one thing all agreed on, that scientific planning was necessary if Britain was to survive."
Yes. There was great enthusiasm for planning. So if you think about The Road to Serfdom, although it's published in 1944, he was thinking about these issues for a decade and a half beforehand. And what he saw when he came to England in the 1930s from Austria, it was in the midst of the Great Depression. Everyone thought that capitalism had utterly failed. And the question was, which direction do we go in? And so these were some of the political setups that were out there that were on offer. But among the British intelligentsia, particularly, socialism was viewed as a middle way. And it was capitalism has failed, but we don't want to go to full communism. Fascism is unattractive. Socialism seemed to be this reasonable alternative in the middle, Lionel Robbins said, planning is the great panacea of the time. And unfortunately, no one tells us exactly how it's supposed to work. So certainly this was part of what Hayek was responding to. He was at the London School of Economics, which was founded by Fabian socialists, so some of his own colleagues he could have theoretical debates about. But he also saw the popular enthusiasm for socialist planning. And, you know, part of what he was trying to do there is to ask people, what do you mean by socialism? Because socialism means the nationalization of the means of production, getting rid of private property, no more firms. The government does everything in terms of production of goods. Is that what you really want to endorse? And some people said, yes, indeed. Capitalism is in such a bad state that indeed this looks like an alternative. But as is true today, for many people, socialism is simply a plea for social justice or less income inequality, just a panoply of things that people worry about, legitimate questions to be debated about, but they call it socialism. So at least in that sense, certainly the book resonates with some of the discussions that have taken place today. I mean, I often teach the history of economic thought. I'm engaging with students, and if we believe the polls, somewhere near 50%, or at least this was perhaps a few years old now, this data point or factoid, that something like 50% of American students, when asked, would you prefer capitalism or socialism, say socialism. So you need to engage people in discussions. What do you mean by that? What is it that is driving that? And okay, if you're not for nationalization of the means of production, what are the sorts of concerns that you have? What sorts of policies might try to address them? Those are the sorts of conversations that I think should be had. And one of the people who read The Road to Serfdom in manuscript form for the University of Chicago Press was himself basically a democratic socialist. And he said, look, I disagree with some of the things in this book, but it's high enough level that it will make the conversation that we have, the public conversation that we have about these issues, better if we have it out there. So he favored its publication. So I think it does, unfortunately, still have resonance that way. He also describes there about the dangers of socialism in his mind, although he thought it was an inefficient way of organizing production. He also worried about the fact that it tends to concentrate power. And he has a chapter in there on why the worst or how the worst get on top. That is chilling, because he describes almost, it could be read, unfortunately, by nefarious people as a how-to manual for demonizing certain groups, setting up a we versus them sort of a polarization that is obviously all too evident in American society today and lots of other countries as well. So he worries about that in The Road to Serfdom, and he worries about how, if you don't have a market system under the rule of law with constitutional restraints that are in place on power, on governmental power, that it's very easy to slip into the into places that no one wants to go to, but that people who think that socialism is the answer to things don't recognize the dangers it brings in terms of the concentration of power that it puts into play.
Yeah, that's right. And it seems that so often the default is to think that some sort of planning is necessary, even if people don't necessarily explicitly endorse the nationalization of industries. You get this sense that frequently in political discourse, there's this talk of having an industrial policy of some kind, you know, with regards to energy or with regards to agriculture. And you'll hear pundits and many others, certainly in the media, refer to how the administration is, quote, managing the economy. Right. As though the economy is managed by a certain set of elites, which sort of suggests that they believe implicitly that there's some sort of design going on or some sort of planning that's at stake.
Yes. One of the groups that Hayek was responding to, particularly in the 1930s when he started to conceptualize The Road to Serfdom, were natural scientists, British natural scientists who were public intellectuals who were saying, look, we have the ability with science now, if you put these experts in charge, to basically banish scarcity, to banish the problems that economists deal with. And if you look at what economists are writing about, said these natural scientists, they talk about a market system, but the market system has collapsed. And if we look at the Soviet Union, they have real support for science there. And they had people who would go over on visits and they'd see the Potemkin villages, and they would listen to the people who were giving them tours, who said, look, we have complete support for science here. We're able to do that because we can concentrate it in a way that you can't in a market system. So, I mean, there was this notion of expertise that we also see today that you were mentioning there, that, you know, we're the ones who are in charge. We're smart. We know what we're doing. We'll handle this. And that was very attractive. when you're in the middle of the Great Depression, this sounds like a very sane way to go. One of Hayek's quotes that is one of my favorite quotes is, the more the state plans, the harder it is for individuals to plan. And everyone likes planning. We don't want to just be walking around randomly, but it's much more difficult to make rational decisions when you've got these big players who are constantly intervening in the economy in one way or the other, and you're not sure which direction it's going to be taking it. So I think there are, Hayek is also known, besides his, with The Road to Serfdom being his most famous book, of talking about how a well-functioning market system is a marvelous device for coordinating human action, creating wealth in a world of dispersed knowledge. And it's the importance of the fact that knowledge is dispersed, yet we're able to coordinate it, that makes the market system such a powerful device for not only producing stuff, but doing it in a world in which people have the ability to make their own decisions, where you have individual liberty. And it's a lovely description that he's able to provide. And it's one that goes it's the counterpart or the counter argument to the notion that, well, we have these experts who have the knowledge. There's always the assumption that they've got this knowledge. Forget about all the public choice problems that they might be corrupted in various ways. But just the simple idea, the hubris of the idea of having enough knowledge to be able to plan a society in the way that industrial planners often say they're going to do is quite amazing. By the way, the industrial, these various schemes for industrial policy have been around for 100 years. I mean, they come and go. So the cost of liberty is constant vigilance, I guess, was famously said. The same arguments keep coming up. Hayek got a little bit crusty towards the 70s because he thought he had answered a lot of these questions earlier in his career, and here they keep coming back. So it is something to recognize.
Yeah. On that note of Hayek responding to criticisms, one aspect of your introduction that I liked very much is that you quote some of his formal responses and publications, and then you also provide some of his more private complaints about the way his critics don't engage his ideas with good faith, or seem to be consistently determined to misrepresent his positions. And that's where you can really see, as you say, his crustiness and his frustration at the repeated attempts to misrepresent what he's saying about socialism or the market order or about the limits of planning.
Right. Well, particularly The Road to Serfdom, I mean, it's got a very provocative title. And so one way that it's often misrepresented is the claim that it's saying that if you have any kind of government involvement in the economy, that it's just you're going to spiral down into a totalitarian state. And he's not an anarchist. He's not he's not a radical libertarian sort. He was someone who said, you know, the idea that all you need to say is laissez-faire is inadequate. But he wanted to put constraints on government. He says, look, if we government's necessary, we don't want to live in a world where everybody has to have guns in order to protect their property. We do want to have the functions of government in place. But having done that, if we're going to give the police power, the coercive power to the state, then we need to put constraints on how it uses it. The first time I thought about that, I thought, this is just such common sense. How can this not be something that is evident, that you want to have you do want to have government, but it does need to be constrained because you are focusing, localizing power. So many people who talk about liberalism, I think they fail to recognize, or neoliberalism when they have the critique, that liberals are fundamentally concerned about abuses of power, which seems to be things that often motivate people who are critics of neoliberalism. And I think they in the same way that Hayek was often not, I think, adequately understood by his critics, I think that that similar sort of thing exists today as well.
Another topic that seems particularly relevant for our age is Hayek's concern about war in The Road to Serfdom. Of course, he has firsthand experience of the First World War and as in London during the Blitz and the bombing of London, and is writing this during the Second World War. In your introduction, you refer to this in several different places. But one of the things you raise, which I think is relevant for our age, is that preparation for war and engagement in war tends to destroy a market system and tends to fall back on this planning that we're talking about. Do you want to say a few words about that, about the way that Hayek tried to articulate this for his readership in England at the time?
Yeah. Well, one of the driving forces for his decision to come out with The Road to Serfdom as a kind of more popular book rather than the larger two-volume work, Studies on the Abuse and Decline of Reason, that it was to be a part of, was that he could see that the argument was being made in England during the war years, during World War II, as it had been made on the continent during World War I, that, well, we've got planning in place for fighting this war. A lot of times what happens to the economy is it becomes, the government takes over the workings of the economy. You don't have car factories anymore. They take over those factories, and they're used to make airplanes and tanks and other vehicles that are necessary for the war effort. Well, if you're a fan of socialism, you say, look, we've got all this stuff in place. Why don't we just keep it in place? That was one of the great fears. And it was something that was being argued for by Lasky, by other people in the Labour Party. Yes, we're fighting the fascists, but we are fighting to have the New Jerusalem afterwards. We're all in it together during the war. Let's stick it out, and we'll all be in it together in the peace, and we'll be living in a socialist world after that. So that certainly was one of the things that was driving him in his decision to write a more popular book or come out with a more popular book. But as I also said at the end of the editor's introduction to that book, that whole war metaphor is often invoked when the government wants to get people to go along with their particular, whatever the program might be. And if we think of the way that the metaphor has been used, the war on drugs, the war on poverty, the war on crime, the war on COVID.
Right.
These are metaphors that are used that say, look, we're all in it together again. It's that same reasoning. So give us the power to do what needs to be done to defeat this enemy. And it's often an open-ended thing. Each one of them, Robert Higgs kind of famously wrote about how there's a ratchet effect, that once you have increased the size of government in one particular area, it's very hard to get it back down because interests suddenly form around its continuation. So it's something that he worried about. And I think it's a very good, as I said, unfortunately, it's a book that does have this timeless element in terms of the problems that he was dealing with, even though he was dealing with it, very specific problems of his time period when he wrote it.
Yeah, yeah. Fascinating stuff and very relevant for debates that we're having today. Now, it was just 3 years after the publication of The Road to Serfdom that Hayek put together the first meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society.
That's right.
So we're kind of in the same era here. And I thought it could be interesting to discuss that event. You've just come out just a couple of years ago with a publication of the transcript of the notes taken by Hayek's secretary of that first meeting in 1947. What was it like putting that together? That must have had its editorial challenges as well.
Yeah, well, it was actually a lot of fun. I was working on the biography of Hayek that the first volume of it, which ends in 1950. So this is right towards the end of it. And we have a chapter on the Mont Pelerin Society. So this is an organization of liberals that Hayek brought together in 1947 for 10 days, beginning of April. And it was a wonderful gathering of people. I mean, if you think of all the titans of liberalism, so you've got the Chicago School people like Frank Knight, Milton Friedman, 34-year-old Milton Friedman, fresh-faced young man, George Stigler, Aaron Director. You've got Lionel Robbins, his friend from the London School of Economics. You've got Ludwig von Mises and Fritz Machlup, colleagues from and mentors from Vienna. You've got Walter Eucken and Wilhelm Röpke, so you're founding fathers of ordo-liberalism, the variant of liberalism that's on the continent. You've got Karl Popper, you've got Karl Polanyi, famous philosophers of science and polymaths. You've got various foundation people, Leonard Reed, who the Foundation for Economic Education had just started up the year before. So he was there with some of his friends, among them Baldy Harper, who was big for the Institute for Humane Studies. The virtually unknown Lauren Red Miller, who actually was somebody who was a fascinating figure, had his hands in everything in terms of trying to promote these various liberal foundations. So he brought together, and then in addition, people from Scandinavia, from France, you know, from Italy. He was bringing them all together because liberalism was in dire straits in 1947. The immediate post-war period was a horrific time period because the Central Europe was divided into four zones. The Soviets controlled a large swath of it, and then the British, Americans, and French, the rest. It was occupied. It was still occupied in 1947 in these various zones. It still had all sorts of controls on the economy. Nothing was going forward. There was a prospect that summer of widespread. You know, millions of people were going to starve to death in Germany. Was the prospect, because all of the food for the food producing regions of Germany were taken over by the Soviets and they were keeping it. Politically, there was all sorts of disruptions. Nationalization was well underway in England. There was all sorts of strikes in the United States, civil war in Greece. The Communist Party was very strong in France and in Italy. It looked like the world was really on the edge of complete collapse. And so this was the environment in which this lonely group of people were meeting. Yeah, obviously, given what Hayek had written in The Road to Serfdom, he had concerns about the post-war period, but he wanted to see if there was a way to bring together people who didn't all agree with one another. One of the things that comes out in the transcripts is how different their views were as to what the way forward was in these various areas. But to bring them into conversation with each other, a lot of them would not have known each other because they're from different countries, and just you know, with the hope that perhaps through this the foundations of liberalism could be explored and identified. So that was his goal, and I came across this transcript when I was working in the Hoover Institution archives in the Mont Pelerin Society papers. And the idea was that this was an off-the-record sort of thing. It is not a verbatim transcript. A few of the entries are from talks that were transcribed beforehand. So there are some that are like that, but many of them are basically the secretary trying to summarize a conversation. But even given that, it was quite a rich document. And I thought it would be particularly important to bring it out. It was published in 2022, so that would be the 75th anniversary of the founding of the Mont Pelerin Society. And indeed, there was a meeting in Oslo where the book was presented to the people who attended the meeting to celebrate it. It was important to me to celebrate the Hoover collection because I think it's a marvelous collection. It has Hayek's papers, but it's got Friedman's papers, Popper's papers, Mont Pelerin Society, Machlup's papers, Haberler's papers. A lot of the people who are important figures in the liberal movement have their papers there, and I wanted to just celebrate their holdings. It's also the case that people who are critical of liberalism, what is often termed neoliberalism today, often say, well, look, it all got its start at this 1947 meeting that Hayek and his fellow cabal members put together, and it's a secret meeting, and it's often presented in very dark and stealthy, stealth was their modus operandi, because they didn't want people to know all the terrible things they were talking about. So I wanted to just get the transcripts out there so that scholars who might be interested in getting a better view of what actually took place are able to read the stuff and see for themselves. So there was also an element there of responding to what I viewed as very biased scholarship in terms of the critique of neoliberalism that's taken place, at least in some quarters.
Yeah, that's a fascinating overview, Bruce. I think it's really important the way you set up the context for the meeting and that survey of Europe in the late 1940s is very important for us to recall, because we think that, or many people who are not deeply read in the history think that the end of the war signaled the beginning of a bright new future of rebuilding and renewed prosperity. But it took some years for that to kick off. And it was a very difficult time after the conclusion of the war in 45.
That's exactly right. Well, this was probably the nadir, April of 47, because it at this very moment, a meeting was taking place. I think it was the third meeting between the foreign ministers of the various Allied powers of what to do to get Europe back on its feet. And the Russians were just dragging their feet, as they had at the earlier meetings. And it was coming back from the meeting that was then taking place in Moscow that Marshall came back and gave his speech in June of 47, proposing a Marshall Plan for the recovery of Europe. So that had not happened yet, but it was just about to happen. So that was one of the things that helped turn things around for sure. But rationing was still in place in England going into the early 1950s. One of the subjects of discussion at the meeting was, what are we going to do about Germany? And it's fascinating because both Eucken and Röpke were advising monetary changes for Germany that ended up being adopted by Erhard, and that a couple of years later of rationalizing the currency and getting rid of the price controls. And both of these things are the things that are generally viewed as kicking off what's been called the German miracle, because Germany recovered very, very rapidly through taking a couple of steps that they were in fact discussing at this 1947 meeting, the liberalization of the economy. And some of the most poignant parts of the transcripts is Walter Eucken talking about just how horrible it is to continue to live under a controlled regime. Where people are basically they're facing starvation, and the system that's in place is going to guarantee that it occurs. So it's a very sobering read.
Yeah.
It's also fun though, because you've got all these personalities of people that people who know anything about the liberal tradition will recognize von Mises disagreeing with Knight, disagreeing with Friedman, right across the board.
And apparently von Mises really did storm out of the meeting, declaring all of the other participants socialists.
There we go. He couldn't put up with all these socialist ideas being floating about.
Good old Mises. I thought it was apocryphal, but apparently it really happened.
Apparently it happened.
yeah. One thing that struck me about the collection is that it was, in some sense, the participants viewed it as being much more than just about the economy.
Yes.
And seemed to be about spiritual malaise and various moral threats as well. I'll just read a passage from your introduction. You write, like Hayek, Röpke was concerned that the past 30 years of war and depression had everywhere undermined confidence in foundational Western values and principles, and that the world was turning for solutions to collectivism, a trend that, in his view, posed a lethal threat to Europe's cultural inheritance. Though an economist, he had in his wartime writings focused additionally on the spiritual and moral dangers that he felt were threatening Western civilization at its core. And you really do get that sense in some of the exchanges that there was more at stake than just a prosperous economy.
Yes, Rupke in particular, I think, stands out as someone who is talking about, I think he really felt that the ideal society would be something like a Swiss canton, where it's small, you know your neighbors, you have frequent interactions with them. He had a vision of what sort of society he liked best, and it wouldn't include a big city, because he had phrases like massification, where you become an impersonal cog in this big machine. And so he was pressing that. Hayek was a very masterful person as a master of ceremonies. He wanted to bring together people who he knew were going to be disagreeing about the way forward, because he wanted to have all of these voices heard. And so it's always hard to tell where he falls on some of these issues. As I'm actually working now on Hayek in the 1950s, and I'm starting to see his vision emerge more clearly. Montpellier Society meetings continue to go on in the 1950s, and he continues to play the role of trying to bring together all different sorts of people. But his own voice is also starting to come out, and particularly in his own writings. And the Constitution of Liberty, in a sense, is his statement of what he views, his particular approach on the principles that underlie a liberal polity. But it is very much one of the things that was important to him, that these voices get heard. The fifth day was devoted to liberalism and Christianity. And so this was the next, and the person, ironically, he was hoping to have someone who was going to be the discussion leader on the session, as someone who would argue for that there isn't a tension between liberalism and Christianity. But the person couldn't come, and he ended up asking Frank Knight to do it, who was known at the University of Chicago as, you know, the campus atheist. So he's taking a strong position that liberalism and particularly Catholicism are incompatible. And again, Eucken was one of the strongest voices in that discussion, because he said, look, Eucken actually lived in Nazi Germany, in Freiburg, throughout the war. At the very end of the war, things looked fairly dicey for him, but he managed to survive. And he said, I've lived in a totalitarian nation. And let me tell you, only under liberalism can Christianity survive, because it's not going to be appreciated by people who are totalitarians, because it will be something that the people will use to say, we have faith in our religion, and we don't have to have faith in the state. So he said it's really under liberalism that it can survive. So that was an important point to make in the context of the times. And it was made based on his personal experience, of course.
Yeah, I was surprised to see a whole session devoted to that subject. It seemed to be an interest of Hayek's to find a way of reconciling liberalism
Absolutely.
With Christianity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, certainly if you think of some European political parties as well, often the ones who would be standing strongest against the socialists would be, Christian Democrats. So you wanted to try to find a way to reconcile liberalism. I mean, there was part of that was just him looking at the political situation. But I think he also genuinely felt that this was not a necessary, this was an historical accident. But there is in Europe, but there was real antipathy between people who self-identified as liberals and people who were Christians, particularly in Catholic countries.
Yeah, and you see that coming out, even though Knight wasn't European, you see that disagreement in that session quite explicitly. And you see this sort of diversity of perspective throughout the volume, and that alone is enough to debunk any claims that there was a cabal that were trying to put forth some sort of ideological vision for the future.
Right. The hardest thing for them to do was to come up with a statement of principles for the society. They had a lot of debate about that. And one of the things that Hayek was very eager to promote was that it be a society where you discuss these ideas and try to come up with principles, see where the disagreements lie, where the agreements lie, and not some sort of think tank, public policy think tank that takes positions on issues of the day. I think of the university problems that universities are encountering today, and the idea of to maintain institutional neutrality for universities to take that position, the kind of Calvin principles that are associated with the University of Chicago. Calvin, by the way, is somebody that Hayek knew. Immediately upon arriving at Chicago, he ran a seminar, and Calvin was one of the people that he invited to the seminar. So these are people who are all sharing these liberal values.
Yeah.
But just the idea that the institution's role is not to take the position on political issues. Individuals within the institution certainly are free to do so, but it's not. We don't speak as one for an institution, because as soon as you go down that road, there's going to be people within the institution who you're not speaking for. In fact, you're saying things that they disagree with. And it's important to keep those distinctions in place if you're analyzing free speech. Calvin was, as a professor of law, is one of the leaders of interpretation of the First Amendment and free speech stuff. So it was great stuff.
Yeah, super. Well, this is a lovely volume that you've put together. It includes quite a number of black and white photos of the event as well, which is very interesting to see some of these figures many people have never seen what they look like. They've mm-hmm. read about them for years, but have never seen what they look like. So fantastic contribution to Hayek scholarship and to intellectual history generally.
Thank you.
There's so much more that we could discuss, but I think this would be a good place to wrap it up. Are there any closing thoughts that you'd like to share, Bruce, before we wrap things up?
Well, I've been talking a lot, so I won't do any closing thoughts, but this has been a great fun for me. You picked up on two of the volumes that were the most fun for me to work on in doing my work on Hayek, so I greatly appreciate having the opportunity to talk about both of them. So thanks for having me on.
It's been a great pleasure. I'm sure we could talk for many more hours about each one of them, so I appreciate you sharing your thoughts.
Thank you again.
Thanks very much.